you, David.
Yes, good evening. Yeah, and we certainly don't know everything or even very much about this particular past yet. So I too want to thank all the sponsors and especially David Feldman for making this happen. And thanks to all kinds of venue and scheduling difficulties in this rather intimidating and impressive, impressive room. And so I'm very pleased to be here tonight. And as I said, we just came from Berlin, where, of course, we've been very much aware of the date yesterday and the events of this week. And so this is a part of the story that isn't generally mentioned when we talk about liberation or aftermath or the experiences of the Holocaust. So this is indeed, as Professor Feldman already said, part of an ongoing project. It's really research in progress. And what I'm hoping to do tonight is to sort of suggest to you another reading, a different kind of reading of the war and the Holocaust by mapping, sometimes literally, by mapping the Jewish experience of death, survival, and continued and renewed displacement via its geographic margins. That is to say, colonial and semi-colonial regions, the Soviet interior, Central Asia, Iran, and just a tiny bit, we can talk about it later, I hope, in the discussion, India, British India as well, before returning to the wartime and immediate post-war epicenters of Poland and Germany. So really what I'm going to do is to talk with you tonight about the stories of these people who you see on the screen, who are survivors of the Holocaust, although they perhaps do not look like the people we might expect to be survivors. We have babies, we have pregnant women, we have some older people, although they're probably not as old as they look. They have just arrived in a displaced persons camp in Seilsheim near Frankfurt in Germany, and the year is 1946. And we're going to go back and talk about what the experiences were that they brought with them when they arrived in Seilsheim DP camp in 1946. And so what I'm going to do is really move the focus away from Europe, from occupied, Nazi-occupied Europe, towards, first of all, that kind of blank spot on the map, that is to say, the Soviet Union behind the lines, and then take us further into areas of Central Asia and Iran, and even into India. So we're expanding the map for a moment. In recent years, studies of the Holocaust have increasingly focused on its aftermath, on questions of memory, on memorialization, but also over the past 20 years, on the acknowledged irony that it was the, quote, cursed bloody soil of occupied, especially American, but also British, occupied Germany, that became a post-war haven for some quarter of a million surviving Jews, so-called DPs, displaced persons, who constituted the tiny surviving remnant, the Sherit HaPleta, as they called themselves, the rest of the rest, the saved remnant of particularly East European Jewry. Those were these people. Much less attention, although that is now changing, has been paid to another irony, that it was Stalin's Soviet Union which provided a crucial, if extremely harsh, and generally quite involuntary refuge, first in Siberia and other remote areas of the Soviet Union, and then in Central Asia, for the majority of that remnant. That is to say, 2/3 to 80% of all Polish Jews, the great mass of East European Jewry, Polish Jews. That is to say, Polish Jewry survivors, perhaps 10% of what had been 3.3 to 3.5 million Jews residing in pre-war Poland who survived, that small group of about 330,000 perhaps who survived, that somewhere between 75% to 80% did so because they escaped Nazi occupation one way or another and ended up, as many of them said later, quote, deported to life in the Soviet Union. This essentially lost history has been preoccupying me ever since I discovered and sort of said to myself, why didn't I know this? During the course of writing my book on survivors in occupied Germany, Jews, Germans, and Allies, this piece of history, which still seems to me to be so key and which has not been adequately, or until recently, hardly at all addressed in our research. It has gone missing in the cracks among Jewish, East Central European, and Soviet historiographies, where its traces can certainly be found, but it has not made it in any sustained manner into either the standard national or overarching Holocaust narratives. No one field wanted to own this story of refugee Jews surviving in the Soviet Union and with help from places like Iran and from sites like Iran and India. There has been, for example, a good deal of research on Poles deported to the Soviet Union and certainly on Soviet wartime evacuees, but not on this story. Nor, and this is something we may want to talk about in the discussion, nor has it been integrated into our own conceptions of what we mean by Jewish experience during the Holocaust, or our definitions, our very sense of the meaning of survivor and survival. It remains largely unmarked in museums and cinematic representations to such important sites of public memory and scholarly work. So that's why we're moving east and then finally also then moving south into our map area. Okay, so you're going to have to bear with me a little bit. This is an unfamiliar, complicated narrative of flight, forced migrations, relief efforts, and sheer endurance. And there is still, after all these years, 70 years after the liberation of the remnants of Auschwitz, so much that we do not know. Who are we talking about? We're talking about some of these people who are, in fact, some of the same people you might have seen at the beginning, several hundred thousand Jews. Some of them, Polish, Ukrainian, Lithuanian, depending on shifting borders, Jews from Western Poland had fled the advancing Wehrmacht into those parts of Eastern Poland that had become Soviet after the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of August 1939. There were also smaller numbers of German, especially Austrian Jews, who had fled to the Baltic Republics in 1938 and were then also became part of this group when Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania were Sovietized. These Jews who fled from Western Poland faced wrenching, difficult, often split-second decisions, or sometimes, depending on shifting borders, shifting battle lines, with a little bit more time, decisions within families as the Wehrmacht was pounding towards them, or sometimes literally about to arrive. about whether to flee or not, about who should go and who should stay. Parents who pushed their youth to run while they could, youth who defied the pleas of their parents to stay with them, or grandparents or parents who said, why should we leave? We remember that the Germans were so civilized in World War I, so much more civilized, actually, than the Tsarist troops. And youth who said, no, we need to leave, and headed for the riverbanks that carried them to the Soviet side. All of these were decisions made in panic and uncertainty, without any possibility of knowing the full situation, much less any inkling of what would soon transpire under Nazi control. Families expected that even if they split up, that they would be reunited. More men than women fled, also on these under conventional gender assumptions that men were more endangered than women, more likely to be drafted, more likely to be arrested, more endangered. More youth than older people fled. All actions that would become dramatically evident in the demographics of the Holocaust itself, in the gender and age balance in the ghettos and in the death camps. Sometimes the Germans actually forced Jews across the border. Sometimes the Soviets let them in. By November, after the war had started, they were demanding permits, but still Jews continued to run east, to run for their lives. Having escaped the Nazis, these Jews from Western, now German-occupied Poland, then, soon thereafter, several months later in 1940, faced a new crisis, deportation as suspect foreigners in a land now allied with Germany, the Soviet Union, to camps like this, forced labor or so-called special camps in what is generally referred to in memoirs as Siberia. But in fact, Siberia could serve as a cipher for other parts of the vast interior of the USSR, including the Urals, Kazakhstan, or as in this case, camp number 53 in the Autonomous Republic of Komi, near the Arctic Sea, west of the Urals. Some of these Polish Jews aroused suspicion, which led to their deportation, simply because they actually registered after a certain amount of time to return to the German side, precisely in order to find family members who had been left behind and who they now knew were perhaps in more serious trouble than they thought. Or, on the other hand, because of false rumors that conditions had stabilized and were less harsh than on the Soviet side. By March, the Soviets had invalidated all Polish currency, leading to further desperate impoverishment. Sometimes out of fear of being forced to accept Soviet citizenship and never being able to return to what they expected would still be home. Sometimes simply because there was no kosher food available in these newly Sovietized territories. At the same time, local Jews living in what had been Eastern Poland, many of them relatives of those across the border, who were just adjusting to novel Soviet control, merchants, shopkeepers, Zionists, observant Jews resistant to the new regime, were denounced as capitalists. And together with the refugees from the Germans, their brethren from the West, no one quite knows how many. This is a story where numbers are very, very hard to come by, though there are historians working very hard on trying to figure them out. But maybe 400,000, maybe 500,000 Jews were subjected to this deportation to life, or at least the possibility of life, in several waves. They were arrested in the middle of the night or early morning hours, joining actually a long history of Tsarist and communist deportees. They too became deportees, given a few hours to collect their personal belongings, and then taken usually to a waiting, unheated train, which carried them in fits and starts, often over weeks, eastward, northward, generally under quite brutal conditions, which some, again, we don't really know how many, did not survive. However, by this twist of history, which then with the onset of the war, intersected in complicated ways with the general mass evacuation of Soviet civilians, including about 1.2 to 1.5 million Soviet Jews into the interior after June 1941, as well as broader deportations of non-Jewish Poles and other suspect foreigners, including a million plus ethnic Germans. So you have to imagine this sort of world of forced migration in the chaos of the pre-war period and then the beginning of the war on the Eastern Front. Several hundred thousand Polish Jews escaped the exterminatory German onslaught that followed the invasion in June 41. Escaped precisely those horrors that engulfed the border territory that Timothy Snyder has now publicized as the Bloodlands. These Jewish deportees labored in factories, mines, forests, or on collective farms. Here we see a group of Polish Jews on a kolkhoz, on a collective farm, actually in Kazakhstan. They endured hunger, disease, exhaustion, mistreatment, sheer shock and bewilderment at their sudden uprooting into completely unfamiliar terrain and circumstances. Trains dropped them off at seemingly random villages and towns, where in the midst of forests, in freezing temperatures, or in the heat of the steppes, depending on what time of the year we were, they were enjoined to build new lives in exile. Mostly urban Poles struggled to adapt to demanding and often very dangerous work in an extreme climate, learning to fell trees at literally breakneck speed, driven by overseers' warnings to work or die. And certainly some, again, an unknown number, did perish. At the same time, and this is key, in contrast to the situation in which their loved ones, their families, their friends, their way of life had been left behind in occupied Poland, Nazi-occupied Poland, these conditions did not specifically or exceptionally target Jews, but to one degree or another, all Poles, Jewish or not, and in many ways, as the war came, all inhabitants of the beleaguered Soviet Union. Families tried to stay together, children were sent to school, babies were born, makeshift barter and bribe systems helped people to survive. Sometimes, and we see this in memoirs and oral histories, sometimes clandestine aid from a Jewish NKVD officer or camp commander helped to sustain life. Here we see actually a class of children going to school in Irkutsk in Siberia. This is a mixed class of Russian and Polish Jewish children. This forced migration away from the Soviet territories first attacked by the Germans therefore provided, and I keep sort of repeating this fact because it still seems so alien, so hard to integrate into the dominant narrative, the main chance for East European Jewry survival. These so-called Asiatics, once they got to Central Asia, they were called Westerners, but once they returned to Europe, they were self-named and named by others Asiatics, who survived the extreme hardships of this Soviet refuge in the Soviet interior and then Central Asia, would constitute, and I'm repeating, the numerical, if not the most visible or most articulate core of the saved remnant, of the Sherit HaPleta, of the displaced persons. Yet we know remarkably little about their everyday life, about the political decisions and wartime contingencies that determined their fate, about their numbers, about the relations between Jewish and non-Jewish Polish refugees, about their encounters with Soviet citizens, Soviet Jews, Uzbeks, local Bukharan Jews, and many other evacuees and deported people in this chaos of wartime forced and emergency migration. We do know that in the summer of 1941, after the German invasion, with the Soviets in dire need of Allied support, Stalin negotiated an amnesty, the Sikorsky-Maisky Agreement, and Sikorsky, of course, will be a familiar name to many of you, with the Polish government in exile, now located in London. And that agreement provided for two key developments: the formation of a Polish army under General Václav Anders, intended to eventually fight for the Polish fatherland in the European theater, and the release, or rather the amnesty, as it was called, of Polish citizens, Jewish and not, from the special camps. And there followed, after this amnesty, after this release, another chaotic, confusing migration. And we don't quite know how organized this was. A rush south to what the free deportees imagined were better and safer conditions in the Central Asian republics, fed on rumors of warm climates and abundance of fruits and other food products, and the notion that they would be further away from the front. And here we see a mother and her two children who have just arrived in Uzbekistan, and you see in the back a sense of greenery, but you also get a sense of how difficult a time they have had and of how hungry they had been. They were greeted, however, by more hunger, severe overcrowding, typhus, dysentery, malaria, all exacerbated by the upheaval of the mass evacuations of Soviet citizens, particularly the cultural, technocratic, and educational elite, away from the advancing front into then mostly Uzbekistan. And this evacuation included, as I've already noted, a significant number of Jews, which was later actually post-war stigmatized in anti-Semitic terms as the Tashkent Front, where Avram supposedly speculated while Ivan fought on with the Red Army and fought in Stalingrad or suffered in Leningrad, which of course was an entirely unjustified claim. But that becomes part of the post-war history of these events. But these Polish Jews found also an amazing variety of wartime improvisations once they got to Central Asia. Universities and theater troops in exile, Red Army recruiters, NKVD agents, local Uzbeks, mostly Muslims, undergoing their own difficult and ambivalent processes of Sovietization. Tashkent in particular had been imagined already in Tsarist times and then in revolutionary times by Soviet planners as a kind of model colonial and then post-colonial city. Confronting these locals who were bewildered by and often resentful and suspicious of the sudden influx of Western Soviet evacuees and Polish refugees, sometimes, however, also astonishingly generous given their own poverty and deprivation. From 1941 to 1942, and according to some records into mid-1943, all Polish refugees, Jewish and not, were at least minimally supported by the London-based Polish government in exile, which was in turn dependent on its British hosts and on private donations, including many from American Jews in North America and from Poles in general for its funding. In an unusual arrangement, the government in exile maintained an official embassy in Kubychev on the Russian-Kazakh border, now Samara. That's another interesting factor here that we're always dealing with changing names, and some 300 welfare offices throughout Central Asia. And just to give you a sense, here you see children gathered together. Again, this is a mixed group in an orphanage, and you see that it says Bukhara Varshava. This is a photograph from Bukhara. I can tell you later about the origins of some of these photos and why so many of them are from Bukhara. Here you see a group of children in Andijan, also in Uzbekistan, actually doing a radio broadcast for the Polish government in exile, which is going to be transmitted back to London. And here you see in Bukhara a group of Polish Jews holding up Yiddish newspapers and Yiddish newsletters, which again already gives you a sense about what a very different world we are living in than the world that these Polish Jews had escaped. And here again, we see a children's group in school, and also in Andijan. I already mentioned that another part of this agreement was the formation of the Polish army in exile. Thousands of Jews, thousands, often half-starved survivors of the special camps, but still technically Polish citizens, flocked to the Anders Army recruiting stations in the Volga region and in Kubitschew. Here we see General Anders inspecting one of his divisions. Initially, Jews were a virtual majority of potential recruits, somewhere between 40% and 60%, but they found themselves rejected, subjected to humiliating inspections and tests, insinuations that they were not good fighting material, unreliable Polish patriots, that they would constitute, and this too will have its consequences later, a kind of fifth column for the later Stalinist takeover of Poland. Moreover, already anticipating what indeed would happen, the British government, powerfully influential in the Polish exile seat in London, were also not particularly eager to see large numbers of Polish refugees leave the Soviet Union, cross the border into Iran, and then, as was foreseen for the Anders Army, move on towards Iraq and then into Palestine for further training, fearing exactly what would in fact transpire. Here we see them setting off for Iran. What would in fact transpire, that many of these Polish Jewish recruits, once they had arrived at their goal in Palestine, would desert. And indeed, of about 4,000 recruits, 3,000 or so did precisely that. A situation that worried the British, who were concerned about the balance in their mandate, but certainly did not overly concern the Poles, who were just as happy to move on without their Jewish comrades. And some of you may know, of course, that the most famous deserter was none other than Menachem Begin, who writes about this in his memoirs, White Knights, except for the fact that he insists he wasn't really a deserter. He was honorably discharged, but that's a very unlikely claim. Jewish representatives also accused the Polish authorities of allowing or coercing Jews to be granted Soviet citizenship at a dangerously fast rate. There was a passportization drive already in January of 43, thus assuring that fewer Jews would ever be able to return to a liberated Poland. In a poignant indication of how the situation in Nazi-occupied Europe was not known, was misunderstood, couldn't be known by those isolated in Central Asia, Jewish Poles complained in 1942 that this policy represented, quote, an easy way to get rid of a great number of Jews. This may create extremely great difficulties for these people when hundreds of thousands will want to return to their families after the war. Between mid-1942 and early 1943, the situation of these Jewish refugees who were already contending with hunger, epidemics, housing shortages, as well as the death and separation of family members in an entirely unfamiliar alien environment, became even more precarious due to the worsening of relations, final breakdown in April 1943. I know there's a lot of facts being thrown at you, but this is a geopolitical story. After Stalin had rejected an investigation of the discovery of the Katyn graves. So therefore, there was this breakdown of relations between the Soviet Union and the London-based anti-communist Polish government in exile, which meant that Jews who had been aided, albeit in often discriminatory fashion, along with all other Polish refugees, by their national representatives in that consulate, in those welfare offices, which were now closed, many of the people who staffed them, in fact, were killed, were now completely on their own in this exotic, unfamiliar, and volatile exile. And in response to this emergency, a new and quite remarkable initiative emerged, which has to do with the story of American Jewry and their involvement in rescue and relief. The Joint, the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, the major Jewish relief organization established in the US right at the beginning of World War I, set up an operation headquartered in Tehran, which together with a Jewish agency from Palestine and various Landsmannschaften of Polish Jews, mostly in Palestine but also in the United States, sent donated food and supplies to suffering relatives in Central Asia through a so-called Persian corridor, the same corridor that these members of the Anders Army are transversing. JDC first inaugurated a modest parcel service from Tehran, and here we're moving into Iran, into the Soviet Union starting in August 1942, not coincidentally, of course, just as the Anders Army, with over 100,000 Polish soldiers and civilian traveling along, perhaps 115,000 Poles entering Iran in all. But despite bitter protests from Jewish volunteers and organizations, only, as I've said, a very limited number of Jews had departed for Iran. They crossed the Caspian Sea and by other routes in two phases, in the spring and summer of 1942. This included, by the way, the famous Tehran children, who may be familiar to many of you, somewhere between 700 and 1,000, probably about 800, Jewish children who left for Iran in July of 1942, together with the army. Here we see some of these Jewish recruits taking a picture right before they left, and you'll notice that there's a woman in the middle. Many of those Jews who were able to join the Anders Army were actually doctors and nurses, medical personnel. Turns out that being a medical, here we are in the British Medical Association, being a medical professional is in most cases a great advantage, I've learned, in times of great emergency. Here we have a photograph taken already in Tehran of two nurses from the Anders Army. One is Polish, one is Polish-Jewish. The story of the joint is, and their efforts in Tehran, has also not been much publicized. It's certainly, I think, not been honored, partially because the joint itself was rather reluctant to talk about it to this day. In part, I think, because they are still actually active in that region. But what we do know is that in the winter of 42, a JDC emissary, Henry Vitellus, traveled to Tehran from Jerusalem via Baghdad to organize a local relief committee in Tehran and to investigate how he could increase the general relief for the much larger number of refugees in Central Asia. He was particularly concerned with the situation in the Jewish children's camp, here it is, outside of Tehran, where these youngsters, officially they are all orphans. That was the requirement for being able to go along with the army. Often they were children who had been placed in orphanages by desperate parents or siblings, if the parents had died, or by one remaining living parent who hoped thereby to provide them with the food that one could get in an orphanage and, most importantly, secure them a route out of the Soviet Union towards Palestine. These children were awaiting transit to Palestine. They would finally arrive there via Karachi and Suez in February of 1943, the only larger group of Jewish children to make it to Palestine during the war. And here you see them in their tent cities right outside of Tehran. Here you see them with their madrichim, with their counselors who had especially arrived in Tehran from Palestine to help take care of these youngsters and children and also to prepare them for life in Palestine. And here we see a young child right before the departure from Tehran, and here finally then the arrival in Atlit in Palestine and a welcome for these children. The JDC was very active in Tehran. Vitellus spoke with diplomatic, military, civil authorities. He spoke with the Americans, the British, the Poles, the American Red Cross, the Polish Red Cross,
residents of the American and British and Iranian Jewish communities, representatives of the Jewish Agency, as well as numerous refugees from Western and Eastern Europe who had arrived in Iran on their own. Now, this in and of itself is an important story. This is, as you see, a permis de séjour, a permission of residence for what happened for a German Jewish refugee in Tehran. In this case, it happens to be that of my own father. The experience and activity of these refugee Jews from Eastern and Western Europe who worked and lived in Tehran over a longer period, not just for several months, also, by the way, on this relief project, bears much more investigation. It's something I'm working on right now, and I'm happy to talk about it more later. It's a story of Jewish refugees, many of them Western Jews, in excruciatingly ambivalent positions, stateless, having left behind their homes, their livelihoods, their professions, contact with the families they've left behind, with no sense of what future they might face. But nevertheless, and this, of course, is a familiar story also to Jewish refugees in other parts of the non-Western world, but nevertheless also Europeans, oddly privileged, adventurers in exotic colonial or semi-colonial non-Western societies. It's also part of another lost history that some Iranian dissidents are actually trying to reconstruct right now, a cosmopolitan nation open to refugees, in which, as described in a marvelous unpublished memoir by a female refugee physician who had arrived in Tehran from Munich, we are all uprooted and put down in this utterly alien culture, replete with adventurous spies, foreign agents, and the wildest rumors, but also often able to find refuge and then work in the forcibly modernizing Iran of Reza Shah Pahlavi, the old Shah, as engineers, teachers, physicians. And just to give you a sense here, you see, these are actually my family photographs. That's my father and my mother riding through the desert in Iran. Here, some friends of theirs doing what I'd like to think of as Weimar-style German gymnastics on a road in Iran. And here again, in the middle of the war, refugees going skiing together with their Iranian helpers and servants and guides on Mount Demavend in Iran. So we see this extreme contrast, in a sense, between what the conditions were in Central Asia and the conditions that refugees found once they got to Iran. This is a story that needs to be told. I don't have time to tell it all to you now. So we return to the center of the story, where, as the JDC noted, the most urgent issue was not the several thousand resident European Jews, but the hundreds of thousands of Jewish refugees still in Russia, whether they remain there or eventually evacuated. They are the problem. So Tehran, already the center of wartime intrigue, especially after the overthrow of the old Shah, who was overthrown by the Soviets and the British and led to a semi-occupation of Iran to prevent flirtations with the Nazis, would become, and this was rapidly clear, a center for relief operations, not only for lend-lease in general, but for a kind of Jewish lend-lease, focused on shipping vital goods for consumption and trading to the Jews trying to make it through the war in the Soviet Union. And this, again, there are so many stories to tell here about the complexities, for example, of the occupation of Iran during the war. I think, and you can tell me if you know another example, as far as I know, Tehran became the only place in the world where refugee Axis country, that is to say Austrian, German, and Italian Jews, actually begged German diplomats to stamp J's in their passports to evade a British roundup of German nationals as once the occupation began. Actually, Jews were given shelter in the courtyard of the UK mission for an entire week to avoid being picked up by Iranian police, who, the British told them, might not be able to distinguish German passports, even if they were renewed with a J, and those of regular Germans. And those J's that let you into the courtyard of the British mission were, as Dr. Lepman reported, worth their weight in gold, which is certainly not something that one can say necessarily about German passports in the UK, and certainly not in British India, where relatively large numbers of Axis Jews were interned as enemy aliens, many of them, although not all, for the duration of the war. At the same time, Iran emerged as the epicenter of Allied politics, but also an early Allied confrontation with the ravages of war. As the Polish refugees, several tens of thousands, including women and children, poured in from the Soviet Union. I already said about 115,000. And it's really interesting to see, if one looks in the archives, that they confronted British and American officials not only with this geopolitical dilemma, how to navigate competing claims among allies, the virulent anti-communism of the Poles, the American commitment to helping the Soviets, the British efforts at controlling the Iranians, the American concern already with future control over oil, all of this happening in the context of the war that was being fought, and the attacks on the Soviet Union, but also with a perceived humanitarian disaster as the Americans in charge of the relief efforts scrambled to contain hunger and epidemic disease among, and this was very interesting for me to read, among these Polish refugees, including Jews, but certainly not only, among these, as they called them, haunting shadows, literally skin and bones for these arriving, particularly women and children, in a situation that the American Red Cross representative for the Middle East, who had been hastily summoned from Cairo to deal with this humanitarian emergency, referred to in 1942, right after the first Anders wave arrived, as, quote, this awful Holocaust, small h. Finally, between July and November 43, just prior to the November-December 43 Tehran conference, which of course confirmed mutual war aims, the JDC, cooperating somewhat uneasily with the Jewish agency, they always had some little conflicts around orderly accounting especially, organized this lifeline to support the Jews scattered throughout Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. They set up a parcel program, a central warehouse, a virtually independent post office where they could avoid customs dues and inspections. And since the Soviets banned any aid shipments to sectarian groups, each circa 10-pound parcel filled with everything from blankets to sugar and tea and soap, and in this case, matzah, both for use and for bargaining on site, had to be mailed to individual recipients. And these recipients were found by name from members of the Anders Army and also from these Landsmannschaften who knew what, or suspected that there were relatives in Central Asia. And by 44, some 10,000 packages a month were making their way on Red Army trucks from Tehran to the Iranian-Soviet border, and then onwards for delivery throughout Kazakhstan and Central Asia. And this, to me, is a fascinating little photo, postcard that I found in the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, because you see with the Russian return address, it's simply addressed to American Joint Distribution Committee, Tehran, Iran. And it actually arrived. And on the back, took me a long time to decipher this, I had to have a lot of help, in Yiddish, it says mostly, thank you very much for the matzah. It's April 1943. I think we can be quite sure that there wasn't only matzah in those packages, but that's what they felt safe saying thank you for. So, What emerges from the files of the JDC is really a rather multifaceted, sometimes quite dangerous, certainly adventuresome operation to support these refugees that was spread throughout the Middle East. There were outposts in Cairo, in Beirut, in Jerusalem, as well as in Bombay. Here, especially the Bombay Jewish Relief Association was quite involved in these efforts. Many, as I said, Axis Jews survived as internees in camps for enemy aliens. Others, especially Polish Jews in the local Jewish communities, working with Baghdadi Jews in particular on Jewish relief. But the efforts were headquartered in Tehran, very importantly, and involved many, many delicate negotiations with multiple parties, the Soviet Union, Iran, Great Britain, the US, the Polish government in exile, various Red Cross groups, and of course, the different Jewish aid groups, the Joint, the Jewish Agency, the Yiddish Socialist Bund, numerous smaller relief groups throughout the Commonwealth from Australia to South Africa or the colonies, India, and then back to London. All these groups had differing politics about Zionism, about relations to Poles, as well as about their relationship to the Soviet Union, whether it might not be better to give to the Soviet war relief in general rather than just to Jews. However, they shared the increasingly desperate goal of rescuing those European Jews who might still be saved. And the very largest group of those who had not made it out of Europe was struggling to survive in Central Asia. Indeed, it is from the testimonies of the Tehran children collected after they arrived in Palestine, and sometimes already in Tehran, that we have some of the most harrowing descriptions of the desperate conditions they faced, those conditions that led that American Red Cross representative to talk about this awful Holocaust. Dysentery, typhus, hunger, decimated families, children remembered. My father and mother got sick with typhus. We cried all night and the next day buried them. There were no doctors because they had all been mobilized. My oldest brother also died. My father got sick. Only my brother and I remained. 7 of us left Poland. 3 died. Of the 15 people, 6 remained. Indeed, many who had fled to the Soviet side of what had recently been Poland and been initially reassured by Soviet promises that we Jews are just as equal as everybody else, an intimation of shared miseries to come, but nonetheless in stark contrast to the murderous violence which they had just escaped, came eventually to see their wartime situation more darkly, as a passage, to quote a memoir, from Nazi inferno to Soviet help. Hell. That was a Freudian slip. Hell. But, and this is sort of the final point I really want to stress, but our exile had saved our lives. Better to have been deported as a capitalist and enemy of the people than to fall into the hands of the Nazis as a Jew. In the end, we were alive. Our exile had saved our lives. Now we felt ourselves supremely lucky to have been deported to Siberia, but that was in hindsight. Because indeed, the death that they faced was of an entirely different quality than that faced by the Jews left behind. It was not total. It allowed for survivors. It allowed for a rather vibrant cultural and even religious life to go on. And significantly, it was a fate shared by non-Jews, although Jewish refugees were perhaps particularly hard hit. But it was devastating nonetheless, ultimately made perhaps even more difficult to bear by the later knowledge that the exiles in Bukhara or Tashkent or Alma-Ata had been the lucky ones. And indeed, even the most critical reports about the inferno to hell recall also the comfort of escaping into school, learning to read Pushkin, Chekhov, or other great Russian literature under portraits of Lenin and Stalin, of eagerly following and cheering on the progress of the Red Army, singing the songs of the great patriotic war, even as a father and older brother daily risked their lives on the black market, and a mother lay sick with typhus and infections untreated for lack of money to bribe doctors or nurses to the degree that they were even there for medication in the one-room mud hut rented out by an Uzbek landlord. So there are dizzying contradictions in these stories. Violin lessons and language courses, or even medical training with some of Moscow and Leningrad's most gifted artists and leading academics in makeshift evacuated high schools and universities. Or, as we see here, actually working in factories and being able to make a living. This is the Sparta Shoe Factory in Bukhara. Here we see a Polish women's club in Bukhara. This is again mixed. These are photos from the Holocaust Museum, so we know that these are Jewish women as well. Here you see a young people's club, again in Bukhara. Obviously, these are not the kind of photos you would see coming out of wartime Poland. Here again, I mean, these are, of course, posed photographs, but still. And here, keep this baby in mind, because at the very end, we're going to see him again. This is baby Ben, who was born in Bukhara in May of 1942. He's holding a red flag. And here he is with his mother, well, dressed up for with a Soviet-style fur cap. And while some remember the suspicion of the Westerners, others recount the warmth of the locals, the sharing of pilaf meals and wedding celebrations, Jacobs, who would be called Yakubs, Hellas, who would be called Hala. This is, here we see refugees again in Bukhara at a chaykhane, a tea house, having their picture taken. Here they are again, posing for photographs. And here you see how important it was to take those photographs. And here you see actually a wedding where Polish Jews join with local Bukhara, Sephardic, not Ashkenazi Jews, in a celebration. And indeed, it was this connection with local Jews that also made it possible to carry on Jewish rituals, such as, for example, circumcisions. Not always, but sometimes. Here again, this is a photo from this wedding. There's an interesting story about the photographer I could tell you about later. And this actually is an orphanage in Uzbekistan, Fata Abad Kolkhoz, which was run by local Uzbeks. And here again, these are the photos that people chose to take and brought back and bring back with them. This is the a mausoleum in Bukhara, sightseeing photographs, and here the people posing in front of the tomb of Tamerlane in Samarkand, and here again, a group. So this is a story that is exceedingly contradictory, exceedingly difficult to understand, to kind of fit into a clear narrative. People have very, very varied memories, and each person has very contradictory memories, but it's an extraordinarily rich and significant story. And very importantly, it is the place where it was possible to maintain a certain level of Yiddish culture. Many Yiddish actors, singers, writers actually continued to hone their crafts in Uzbekistan and then carried that Jewish culture, that Yiddish culture, back with them to the DP camps where they shared it with Jews who had lost everything. In July 1945, now we're getting to the end of the war, in July 1945, this is VE Day in Bukhara, there was a new agreement between the Soviet Union and the new Polish government. The repatriation of Polish citizens was organized. Jews returned yet again on trains. They were repatriated. But they were repatriated to what had become and what they really did not know was a vast graveyard, as they said. So the refugees returned to Poland. We don't know how many, probably around 200,000. Some estimates speak of 230,000 until 1949. They arrived after long, circuitous, arduous journeys, many of them between February and July 46, just as, not coincidentally, post-war anti-Semitic violence reached a climax in Poland with a notorious pogrom in Kielce on July 4th. And it's not an accident that those two events coincided, because it was not the very, very tragically few survivors who emerged from the death camps and the labor camps and from hiding and from passing on the Aryan side, or even from the partisans who constituted this larger group of Polish Jews that aroused so much anger and fear and resentment among Poles who thought that they had been gone and that their property and their possessions were now theirs. This is a very important part of the story of post-war Polish anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. Some trickled back even later, after their release from camps and prisons. And when the trainloads, and it's really important to remember, these are trainloads. We have some extraordinary descriptions of these Jewish repatriates arrived in Łódź, in Radom, in Krakow, in Warsaw. The few survivors of the ghettos, the camps, and hiding turned out to welcome them in gate, as they wrote, in a world where among the several 10,000 of 3.3 million Polish Jews still alive, there were hardly more than 100 Jewish families which still stood intact. We came to gaze on, quote, walking miracles, whole Jewish families complete with fathers, mothers, and children. Of course, that wasn't always the case. But still, other refugees recalled, when the women saw our children, they could not believe their eyes. They all said, you still have children. Ours have all been killed. It was at these border crossings that the Asiatics first came face to face with incontrovertible evidence of the Nazi atrocities, rumors that had been dismissed as Soviet propaganda. And it was indeed this relatively large group of Jews returning who formed the core of a brief efflorescence of post-Holocaust Yiddish culture, especially in places like Łódź, but also Szczecin, Wrocław, Breslau, areas, interestingly, that at the end of the war had then been cleansed, if you will, of Germans who were then fleeing or expelled, if you will, into Germany. But it was them, these Jews, who provoked, if you will, post-war violence and then triggered the mass exodus of surviving Polish Jews into the American zone, where historians of the Holocaust and post-war Germany, like myself, picked up their story without, however, really examining or understanding the experiences they brought with them. So, what are we left with? Political, ideological, psychological factors, certainly the pressures of the Cold War, the dominance of a unified narrative that subsumed all Jewish DPs under this rubric of the Sherita Pleta, and their own need to be part of that collective, the enduring sense among the repatriates that their story was not worth telling in the face of the catastrophe, the Choban, that had befallen those who had been left behind, have shaped and distorted history and memory. These repatriates who arrived home to a home that was no longer home, starting in late 45, became part of an undifferentiated collective of survivors, as we call them, which was in many ways only invented after the war, first in Poland among the refugee committees in the early Jewish communities, and then after the mass flight in the DP camps. Shocked by the mass graveyard, these repatriates accepted that role of not telling their story, especially as they found themselves forced to flee again, especially into the American zone, stateless refugees again, without passports or with false papers, carrying their children born in Uzbekistan or on the way, backpacks containing the last of precious black market goods from the bazaars of Central Asia, tossed or stolen along the way. They crossed more borders. Here they're in transit through Czechoslovakia. into Austria, or into, through the Soviet zone into the American sector of Berlin, moving now from east to west rather than from west to east, seeking safety among the Americans, hoping to emigrate further out of cursed, blood-soaked Europe to Palestine, the United States, Canada. And here we see them. This is the courtyard of the Rothschild Hospital in Vienna. Again, the women with their babies. And these are not the children that were born in the DP camps. These were the children who were born in the Soviet Union or on the way. And here, I love this photo because it's so unusual to find fathers, photos of fathers with babies, also in Vienna. And here, a group of orphans, also in Vienna. Here, people boarding illicit buses. This is part of the semi-clandestine Bricha flight movement. Trucks that would take them to Berlin. Their Soviet story was silenced and lost. They end up in the DP camps. This is a shelter in Berlin. And here we see a mother, her child, and her father just arrived in another DP camp in southern Germany, in this case, in Felderfing. This is their story. And here, these children, you can tell by their age, these are not concentration camp survivors. What happens? The story is silenced. The historical commissions set up by the DPs to document and commemorate the Korban, who had themselves survived in the Soviet Union, recorded almost entirely only the stories of the camps, the ghettos, the partisans. DP journalists and poets who published in the DP press focused on persecution, resistance, Zionist politics, everyday life among the DPs, but hardly ever on what they had experienced in the Soviet Union. Actors and actresses donned striped pajamas and played victims in German camps when they themselves had arrived as infiltrees from the Soviet Union. They wanted a home among a community of survivors. The memories they were to recall were not the memories that they themselves had, with their strange trajectories from Warsaw and Vilna to Moscow, to Siberia, to Tashkent, to Fergana, Frunze, Alma-Ata. It's a very interesting movie, Unsere Kinder, that some of you may know, which addresses this. And when they finally left the DP camps, would-be immigrants, especially to a reluctant U.S. mindful of escalating Cold War tensions, they supported a thriving industry of false papers, backdating their entry into Germany, or inventing new later birth dates for children to disguise their Soviet birthplaces, as with these children, and here they are as the committee members administering the DP camps. This is actually Berlin, Schlachtensee. He too, a repatriate from the Soviet Union, now a member of the DP police, the famous weddings, the baby carriages. This is the DP story we know. The children, the kindergartens, again, these children are not babies. The schools. And this is Ben again. Now, older, riding his bicycle in Schlachtensee DP camp in Germany, in Berlin. So, this overarching story of the Holocaust, its victims and survivors, has effaced many other stories that we need to know. The highly ambiguous role of the Soviet Union as the site where, with some significant financial support from American Jewish aid organizations, the great majority of at least Polish Jews, the majority of East European Jews, had survived. And there's a great deal more to be said about the JDC. And I think it's important to realize that these facts relativize, albeit in surely marginal ways, the dominant story also of US and especially State Department indifference, if not hostility, to the fate of the Jews. And one might think about the contrast to, for example, to the anxieties of empire, which so severely limited British rescue efforts in places like India or Kenya or the Caribbean, as well as Palestine. So here on the geographic margins, the only truly viable rescue efforts could still be mounted, even before there was a clear sense of the scale of the catastrophe, but there was a palpable sense of agency and mission. So the more we learn about this, the more complicated this remapped history becomes. Arguments about definitions of survivors, generally considered in terms of differences among pre-war refugees and survivors of Nazi occupation, become even more vexed. In fact, if we, as many do and still do, discredit these people as survivors, then the number of actual survivors and their descendant generations becomes drastically smaller, even more tragically small. Today, and I haven't been very recently to the Imperial War Museum, but certainly in the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, these people do not exist. They are counted and identified collectively as survivors, but we do not know about their wartime experience, nor have they been recognized as such. Sometimes people are even worried that if we disaggregate this collective, that the post-war German argument about the DPs being really refugees from communism and not victims of Nazism, that their fate was the normal misery of wartime and not the particular horror of the Final Solution, thereby absolving German guilt, that if we tell this story, we might revive or reactivate that story. So we have so many questions. What was the role of this repatriation in inflaming Polish post-war anti-Semitism? What role did the uniformly negative memories of Poles' deportation and exile play in these post-war anti-Semitic outbursts? What role did the Jewish the ambivalent Jewish experience in the Soviet Union play perhaps in the fact that Jewish DPs never shared in the implacable anti-communism of Polish and Baltic DPs, nations in exile? How do we see what I wrote about in my book, these many pragmatic close encounters among surviving Jews and defeated Germans, in a different light if we realize that their most recent experiences had been with Poles and Russians, Soviets, and not with Nazis? How might we understand the often stigmatized and anti-Semitic terms post-war black market among DPs if we think of it not in terms of the extreme conditions in Nazi ghettos and camps, but in relation to the barter and rationing systems that made for survival possibilities in Siberian labor camps or on Lenin streets in Central Asia? There are so many stories. How did this affect this national security obsessed immigration politics of the Cold War Western powers, especially the US? How did it affect the relationships between the young State of Israel and the Soviet Union? All of these tales of survival, forced labor, arrests and sudden releases, encounters with staunchly communist Soviet Jews, hardship and exoticism remain alien to our standard narrative. They are difficult to integrate into personal as well as public memory. Here they are again, these children. These privatized memories got lost when they were incorporated into a collective of survivors, memorial and mourning rituals that could not accommodate their history, that were really hard to explain, to form into any kind of coherent narrative. Here they are about to move on from the DP camps. Here they are in the DP camps. It's not an accident, I think, that so many of the memoirs, particularly of this group, contain maps, as in this case, he traces his journey all the way from Warsaw to Tashkent, and then to Tehran, and then finally, he makes it to Israel. As if they're trying to explain to themselves, as well as to others, these unlikely journeys that don't really fit. And so, how can we understand this experience, and how do we know how it shaped Jewish understandings of their own persecution and extermination, as well as their definitions and self-definitions as survivors? How did these Jews, the majority. Some camps were populated entirely by infiltrees from post-war Poland who had returned from the Soviet Union, negotiate their own excruciatingly complicated encounter with both Nazism and Stalinism. So this is the story that is now emerging from archives, from unpublished memoirs, stories transmitted to the second and third generation. I get more and more every day. If we really start to look at these rescue and relief efforts, at these very difficult experiences in the Soviet Union, but also what was organized out of Tehran, and for example, the Jewish Relief Association in Bombay, I think we do begin to remap the landscape, not only of suffering, but of rescue and relief. We decenter for a moment Palestine and Europe, even as they remain the key sites to which the story returns, and reasserts the limited but real efficacy of individual and organizational initiative, reframes the range of allied, especially Soviet and US maneuvering in regard to rescue. In sum, the path traversed by European Jews from Poland to Siberia, Central Asia, Iran, sometimes back to Poland, then onto the American zone, or in some cases, directly to Palestine, usually followed by renewed flight and displacement. All of these stories, if we tell them, I think will remap and rethink the history that we are commemorating this week, rendering it transnational, multidirectional, in challenging different ways, and helping us to understand the Holocaust, its victims and survivors more deeply and more comprehensively. Thank you.